Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. So today we're going to look at background. So you can see here there's just a plain white background, but how would you change that if you wanted it to be more exciting? We'll just go to edit section and then background, and you can see you've got three options. You've got a image option, a video option, which tells you how much video you can store on the site at the moment, how much playback you've got, and also you can put a separate image in for mobile devices that might not want to load video, which is quite helpful. But if you go into image, and then you can upload a file, or in this case, I'm going to choose an existing one from some of the images hosted elsewhere. So let's go with this one of an aircraft that's gone into the drink a little bit over here on the left. So you just select that, add it, it's there, and now you can see I have a few different options. There's some effects. I don't particularly want those effects, but they're there if I wanted them. And then I can go and adjust the opacity. So if the image is perhaps overwhelming the text, I can make it lighter. If I want more, I can do it darker. I can make it full bleed or inset. So there you go, I put the opacity to 60. And full bleed means that the header is also covered by the image, which I think works with where the tail of that aircraft is. Save and you're done.
So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenafel. You can get a free trial, and once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show.
Well, last year I was lucky enough to be able to visit the Shipwreck Centre and Maritime Museum on the Isle of Wight. So today we're going to have a look at what you can find there. Now, for those of you who may not be aware, the Isle of Wight is an island just to the south of the UK general coastline. Best access from Portsmouth. If you want to drive, there's a car ferry. If you want to walk or take public transport, there's a hovercraft ferry. Yeah, we still have some of those. Unfortunately, the hovercraft car ferry, which was really, really cool, is long gone, but you can't have everything in life. And part of the reason that the museum is there is simply because the Isle of Wight has an awful lot of wrecks around it. Now, these are some of the more famous wrecks: HMS Swordfish, an S-class submarine from World War II, SMUB-81, that's a World War I-era German U-boat, HMS Acheron, there's a whole bunch of fifth rates, there's HMS A1, an early submarine, HMS Invincible. Royal Navy doesn't really have a good track record with ships called Invincible. This particular one's another age of sail vessel. And if you think that's a high concentration of wrecks, well, here's a map that shows most of the recorded wrecks, i.e. where we know that a ship did go aground either on the Isle of Wight or close to it. And this is just for the past couple of hundred years. So anything that went down in the first part of the Napoleonic Wars or earlier, well, that's not on this map. So there's a huge amount of shipping and therefore naval history contained beneath the waves around the island. And a number of these wrecks have been dived, surveyed, and salvaged, and then marked for preservation by the owner of the museum, Martin Woodward. Now, for those of you who are familiar with ship salvage operations in the current era, Martin Woodward hardly needs an introduction. But for those of you who maybe haven't heard about him, well, you'll have heard about him a lot by the end of this video, as we're lucky enough to get an interview with him later on. Now, some of these wrecks were fairly well known at the time, and so recovering artifacts from them is a way of preserving their memory in a way that commemorates the tragedy that was already known. However, other artifacts shown, not just in this photo but elsewhere, are actually vital pieces of essentially archaeological detective work, because often it wasn't known what happened to a given vessel until it was discovered by Mr. Woodward's efforts and along with his crew. And that obviously brings closure to those who may have had relatives aboard those ships or submarines who just never knew what happened to them. They just sailed off one day and never came back, and no one knew where they'd gone. And so the discovery process is very important, but also the preservation and display process, because that gives relatives somewhere to visit with some physical, tangible connection to the ship that their loved one went down on, and also allows for a much more certain identification, because of course sometimes you can get lucky and the wreck might have something very definitively identifiable just by looking at it on the seabed, But other times, you need to bring up components to double-check or triple-check them in detail. So, for example, you can see here, some of these artifacts are from the aforementioned submarine HMS Swordfish, which, according to Navy records, had departed on a mission and just vanished. And leading theories were that she was perhaps somewhere in the Eastern Atlantic, somewhere maybe down in the Bay of Biscay. As it turns out, she was actually much, much closer to home, just off the coast of the Isle of Wight. Now, we will be looking in considerably more detail in a future video at some point at the histories of some of the wrecks recorded here at the museum, as well as some of the artifacts associated with those wrecks, and in sort of slightly happier circumstances, some of the other marine artifacts that have been recovered from ships that didn't sink. But today we're going to look at another aspect of maritime wrecks and salvage work that's preserved at the museum, and that is actually the history of diving and the history of salvage work and how that's been carried out over the years. Because, of course, salvaging wrecks is not a new activity. It's been done for hundreds of years, partly to recover cargoes, partly to recover extremely valuable items that aren't necessarily cargo, like ships' guns, especially when those were made of bronze, sometimes to discover what had happened to the wreck, and sometimes to actually recover the entire wreck itself, because, yeah, full-scale ship salvage was definitely a thing, even back in the Age of Sail and before. So in that respect, let's go and see what we can find in this wonderful little museum.
Now, of course, there is the question of, yeah, all these wrecks are out there, fantastic, but how do you actually get down there to examine them? And to do that, because obviously shipwrecks were a very valuable source of salvage way back into antiquity, you know, the metal itself would be very valuable, especially back in ancient times, stuff like bronze fittings would be worth something. The cargo, if it was a cargo ship, could be worth something. If it was an ancient warship, the bronze ram, for example, would definitely be worth something, and some of the other bits and pieces as well. And as time went on, obviously ship's cannon and perhaps the pay chest would be worth having as well. And if you couldn't salvage the whole ship, get it up out of the water, then the best thing to do was to go down and get stuff out of the ship. But the earliest technology to do that, other than just free diving, was something like this. So this is a replica of a diving bell, this particular one from the 1600s. And the idea is very simple. As you can see, you have a basic wooden bench and a pitch-sealed, essentially half barrel at a large scale, and that would get lowered off the boat, and it's got weights, so it would sink. But of course, you now have this bubble of air, so you could sit in your diving bell and be lowered to the shipwreck, and then you would be able to swim out. So essentially, you're free diving, but with some assistance. And as once you swam out, you could go and do whatever salvage work you wanted to do on one breath, and then you'd have to pop back to your diving bell, come up inside, take a couple of breaths, reset yourself, back out you go. It wasn't a huge improvement because you were still limited in operation to, as I said, what you could do on a single breath hold, but it was a considerably better option than just free diving from the surface, especially when the wrecks were at any particular depth. Of course, you did run the risk if you were down at any significant depth. Of course, the water pressure would compress the air in the diving bell, so you'd be breathing that compressed air. You yourself would be compressed operating at depth, which meant that if you were then raised back up, you could run the risk of the bends, because that wasn't really a fully understood thing back then. But it did depend very much on how deep into the sea that you'd gone. So that's kind of your first stage of any kind of assistance for salvage work. But then they came up with something a little bit newer. So let's see what that is. So just adjacent, we have the Lethbridge diving barrel. And yeah, it pretty much is exactly what you'd think it is. It's an elongated barrel, this time sealed. As you can see, got some clips up there at the top. And it's got this essentially keel weight, so it's facing down. And you put a person inside. And then as you can see here, you've got these little leather seals on a couple of holes. So you stick your arms out to do work, and you probably can't see here, but just under there, there's a little viewport.
So essentially, this is a very early diving suit, but being rigid, it's more like a modern day wasp suit than a scuba gear suit. Of course, the problem is that because this thing has to be open and shut and open and shut, it's not possible to make this thing entirely watertight. So it would leak. And of course, there's no way of renewing the oxygen inside this thing. So although this would allow you to be, as you can see with all these ropes, towed across the wreck and conduct work whilst breathing, so unlike the diving bell, you're not restricted to what you can do in a single breath, you are going to have water potentially leaking through your arm seals, potentially water leaking through the seams. If it hasn't been sealed properly, there'll be perhaps water leaking through there. Plus, you're going to have a slow buildup of carbon dioxide, although again, given that this is the 17th and 18th century, they're not necessarily going to understand exactly why you start to feel lightheaded after a certain amount of time. And of course, you know, that leather being pressed in by the pressure of the water, you're going to end up with some really nasty chafing or ligature marks on your arms as well. But as you can see with this dummy, he's setting up a rope around a cannon. You could work for a reasonable time, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes, which would allow you to do a complex task that you couldn't just stop and then come back to, like roping up a cannon, which would be a very valuable thing to salvage, and bringing that back up to the surface. So that was your option if you didn't want to use the diving bell once you get into the, well, 1500s, well, end of the 1500s, mostly the 1600s and 1700s. But then, of course, technology continues to improve. So let's see how that works. So this stuff you might be more familiar with. This is what you might think of more immediately when you think of an old diving suit. So rubberized canvas, sometimes leather, or at least certainly bits of leather. Got a nice weight to keep you weighed down. Big leather boots as well. The whole thing is quite heavy, but that's needed to, you know, keep you on the seabed, because this has to be negatively buoyant, because there's a lot of trapped air in here as well, which will make you feel more buoyant. And then you've got your classic bronze or brass, depending on the manufacturer, diving helmet with your various portholes. Now, this is actually a surprisingly old bit of kit. Starts to see major use in the early 1800s, but there are earlier versions that go back a little bit further than that. So yes, age of sail warships, salvage work, maintenance work, etc., would have been done by this, certainly in the latter part of the age of sail. If you're ever aboard HMS Warrior, they have a diving suit, and a warrior did historically carry one for work underwater. But you'll notice there's no air tank. There is, however, these hoses. So you were supplied with air from on the surface, and that's what these are for. This is a diving pump. So you'd have to have some of your mates cranking this constantly to keep you supplied with air, and obviously that would mean that the carbon dioxide buildup you'd suffer with the diving barrel also wouldn't be a problem, because the stale air would either escape either through bits of the suit or back up the line. But you were relying on your friends constantly cranking, A, because the minute they stop, you don't get any fresh air supply. But also, if you went somewhat deeper, there was the other problem of pressure. So if somebody was cranking away, you know, maintaining a certain level of pressure in your suit, and then they stopped, well, then the water's going to keep pressing in, it's going to force the air out of the suit, up through the line, and then it's going to start thinking about trying to force you up through the line as well. Of course, that depended very much on how deep you'd actually gone. If you hadn't gone too deep, it would just be uncomfortable. If you'd gone a bit deeper than that, that could start to be a bit of a problem. And even if you weren't forced up a very thin line, just the sudden increase in pressure on your body could be problematic, to say the least. But this stays around for a very, very long time, basically because no one can really improve on it all that much, other than, you know, maybe having a powered air pump rather than a hand-cranked one. So for those of you who've seen the documentary series I did on the salvage from Pearl Harbor, although some early versions of what we would today deem to be scuba suits, although they weren't scuba suits back then, a self-contained breathing apparatus, Some examples of that were used during the salvage in Pearl Harbor. The vast majority, and what you can see in some of the film footage, is stuff like this. You know, with literally the classic bronze and brass helmet, people with airlines attached to them. That's how they did the vast majority of the underwater salvage work at Pearl Harbor. And it's only really supplanted by, again, what we would today recognize as scuba gear, actually well into the Cold War. The self-contained breathing apparatus that was available in the Second World War was a little bit finicky and nowhere near reliable enough or long-term enough to be used extensively in something like underwater salvage work. And then in this central part of the display, we come back to the diving bell. Now, we saw an earlier one. This is a slightly later one. It's got a little portal up the top as well, so get a bit of light into the situation without, you know, taking a candle down or something that's going to burn up your oxygen even faster. But one of the things that's perhaps not known is that diving bells, although all this other technology supplanted them as frontline units, they still remain relevant both in, you know, the older period, the age of sail and so forth, but even through to the modern day, diving bells and variations on diving bells are still in use to a certain degree in underwater exploration and salvage work. Sometimes still as a reserve of air if you're, you know, free diving or, you know, not carrying a huge amount of air with you, but even for divers in modern gear who do carry their own air tanks and everything, a diving bell can be a very useful place to ride down to a certain depth, because the modern ones can be pressure controlled, and to ride up, and it gives you the option of having a separate amount of air compared to your tanks. So if you're going on a particularly deep scuba dive for, again, long-term work like a salvage operation, if you're in a modern diving bell, you can be lowered down, so you save yourself a bunch of energy. You are then obviously pressurized to the depth, you do go off and do your work, and then rather than have to hover and do everything yourself in terms of your decompression stops and everything coming back up, you could instead just sit in the diving bell and it'll all be done for you. And of course, if something goes wrong, you can load someone in the diving bell, they can be hauled up, you can store extra equipment in the diving bell, and as I said, if you suffer some kind of catastrophic failure, either you overbreathe, or a line gets severed, or a tank stops working, or ices up possibly, which is a risk in deep water scuba operations, then you have the diving bell there as a separate source of air immediately to hand, and something that you can actually then, as I say, sit in and wait and go through your decompression stops, even if you don't, your external air tanks aren't working anymore. Which is very, very handy, because, yeah, the last thing you want to do is like, okay, well, my air tank's frozen up, also I now have to get, who knows, you know, 40 meters back up to the surface on my last unexpected breath of air manually, so you're burning a lot of oxygen, and you're having to do it really quickly, so you will get the bends. Instead, just go into the diving bell, and you should be okay. So, perhaps an underappreciated bit of underwater equipment. Now, what all of this allows, of course, is to have a look at all the shipwrecks. And the shipwrecks are why we're here, to look at all the artifacts related to them.
But of course, it's all very well looking at the exhibits in the museum, but, well, if you get a chance to talk to the man who found most of those exhibits in the first place, you can't really pass that up. And so, let's do that.
Right. Hello, everybody. We are here in the Isle of Wight, pretty much near the centre, at the Shipwreck Centre and Maritime Museum. And we're extremely lucky because we've been able to get a few minutes with Mr. Martin Woodward, who's, well, if you come here, pretty much almost everything you see here has pretty much been dragged off the seabed by him at some point or other. So we're going to ask a few questions. So roughly how long have you been doing this?
Well, look at my face. I started diving in the 60s. Then I became a commercial diver in 68. So you're looking at 56 years now. So long time, and pretty much a lot of the early time I did shipwreck work, and then I went to the North Sea and did the deep diving, Middle East and that, and then came back to the shipwreck stuff later on because it's always been my greatest love, basically. Mm-hmm.
So it started off with commercial shipwreck exploration.
Yeah, no, mainly commercial diving, you know, in general, and then oil fields and, just literally commercial work around the world. But my love has always been shipwrecks. And, of course, right back from the very beginning, from my teens, I was always keen on shipwrecks. And I always wanted to keep whatever I found as a bit of a moral obligation to keep it together rather than take it down the auction house.
So. Yeah, yeah.
So that's how this was born, really. In 1978, we set up the museum in Bembridge. And here we are 46 years later, so still going.
Yeah, and so what made you choose the Isle of Wight as your kind of base to look around? Or because I know you've gone overseas as well, but a lot of this is obviously Isle of Wight. So is that just because you're from here, or because it's really rich in wrecks?
It's a combination of the two, really, because, I was brought up here. So I lived in Bembridge when I was a kid, and I was lucky enough that you had all the ledges in all the rock ledges and wrecks around. And, of course, the Isle of Wight is one of the most prolific areas for shipwrecks. You know, there's probably a couple of thousand of shipwrecks around the Isle of Wight. Obviously, then in my diving career, I was in various places around the world. But because I was brought up here and because, you know, I wanted to create the museum here, this was the obvious place to do most of it. And I was lucky. I count myself very lucky. The fact that, you know, I was around at the right time. Nobody had done anything on the wrecks. A lot of the wrecks were uncharted. I invested in the gear, you know, magnetometers and sonars and things. And because it was that particular time, then I could go out and find all these wrecks that had never been touched. And, of course, that's special because it doesn't matter whether it's 500 years old or wartime, you're the first person to touch and see that particular shipwreck.
Yeah, since it disappeared. So of all the wrecks that we've seen, I know this might be a bit of a stretch, but are there any wrecks that stand out to you as kind of you're really happy you found that one?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are two in particular. One is the Mendy, the SS Mendy, which is a very famous wreck, as you know. That was solving and unravelling a mystery that we didn't even know about. And I mean, I'd done a huge amount of research in the early years. That's what I used to do when I was locked up in those chambers up in the North Sea, talking like Donald Duck. I'd be there with my books and researching wrecks when we weren't diving. So to unravel that story was probably one of the most special ones. You know, 646 people died off our shores and none of us knew about it. It had just been sort of kept either covered up or just kept out of the limelight because it was a huge loss of life just off the Isle of Wight. And the ongoing story of that, and we ended up with a centenary back in 2017 where, you know, Princess Anne and dignitaries came from South Africa. They sent a warship up with the bands and everything. So it's very poignant and satisfying to know that you were you had actually been responsible for creating all that just by finding the wreck back in 1974. The other one is the one the HMS Swordfish. Again, that's a special one to me because the HMS Swordfish was a submarine that sank in 1940. It left Portsmouth, left Fort Blockhouse, and went out to take up a patrol off the western coast of France, off Brest. It had a predetermined time, rendezvous time with the HMS Usk. They didn't, obviously because of radio silence and the presence of the Germans in that area, they didn't communicate at all, so they just had a predetermined time. They always assumed that she got down off Brest because there was a bit of depth charging activity on the 16th of November 1940, a few days after she'd left. And they had just assumed she'd been depth charged and the crew all lost. Fast forward to 1983, I was looking for wrecks off the Isle of Wight, systematically searching with magnetometer sonar. And I came across this submarine and I thought, it's got to be a German submarine because there's nothing in the records of a British submarine in this area except for one that had been scuttled. And when I found it, I thought, oh, this is strange. It's a S-class British submarine. And of course, I went home, and it could only be the swordfish. And obviously, subsequent diving, it proved it was.
Yeah, there's a fair few artifacts from her on display here. So
yeah, the only reason for that, because I never touch war graves. Mm-hmm. I have a policy; it's not worth ever upsetting people. Mm-hmm. The authorities, the dockyard, the submarine museum, specifically asked me to bring up items that would identify it, to definitely identify it. And the same with another wreck, or the Akron. I just brought up something that they could actually say, well, this is off the Akron, so that they could say that was definitely the wreck. Yes. So that's the only reason that we've got stuff here. Mm-hmm. And it's a great memorial, because one of the crew's wives, he used to come here every year and use this like a memorial. Because they had nothing else before except to look out to an expensive sea, either off the French coast or here. So it's good for the families as well.
So when you found swordfish, you're kind of looking for wrecks generally. How often is it the case of, you know, you're looking for something and something appears, and then you have to work out what it is, as compared to I'm looking for this specific thing? And you find it?
It's a good question, because it happens often, especially in this area, because there was so much in the way of sunken shipwrecks that the hydrographic department had never identified, because obviously, in fairness to them, they just track up and down wide tracks back in the 50s, 60s. And they just assume that if wreck A is in the same area as the reported position of wreck B, then wreck A will become wreck B, if you like. So yeah, the Mendy was a classic example of that. Mm-hmm. Because what happened with the Mendy, there was a hydrographic report. I had all the old hydrographic reports. A lot of it was really inaccurate, but they had what they thought was an old Admiralty barge in that area, and when I went and pinged this wreck and found it, which was close by. When I went down, I thought, well, this is not this was a quality ship, and it was obviously not what was thought in the records. So that happens, but it also happens with old wrecks. Some of the wrecks that I found going back hundreds of years, some of the wrecks from, I found one particular site that was mixed with, 1300s, 1400s era, and 1600s era. I've never ever, and I'm an ardent researcher, I love to find out. The story is not complete without the research behind it. And I've never been able to find out what they were. I found out by things that I found the name of a person that was aboard it, but I've never found out, because there was no record. It obviously sank. They sank in the middle of the night. Locals wake up in the morning and find wreckage on the beach and a few bodies and don't know where it came from. So, yeah, it happens a lot, even with modern wrecks. But swordfish was a classic example of that. Yeah. I systematically work an area, mowing the lawn, as we call it, tracking up and down with the equipment. It's a process of elimination. So you're going to find I've done probably 500 square miles of that around the Isle of Wight over the last 50 years. So.
One of the things that has always struck me when I've looked at warship wrecks is the fact that you have all these, logs, and it's like, oh, so and so sank at X latitude or Y longitude. And to us in the modern day, perhaps used to GPS and everything, we think, it must therefore be there.
Yeah.
And people forget. Well, firstly, they didn't have GPS then, so it was a lot of dead reckoning. So they might say that, but look at, say, when Bismarck sank, every ship has a position for Bismarck sinking. They all disagree.
Mm.
And then once a ship actually sinks, if the water's of any great depth, the wreck's going to go one way or the other. It might end up miles away from where you thought it was, and it might not have been there in the first place.
The errors in those days, for the reason you say, a lot of it was dead reckoning. This happens a lot. It happened with the HMS Edinburgh. There were all these different theories about where she was, and in the end they were lucky. I missed that job. One of my biggest regrets, because I was offered it but I couldn't go. I was having some operation on my back, but it happens all the time. Because some of the wrecks I've found have been 20 miles out of position. Well, the swordfish 250 miles out of position. But It was really satisfying to find that, because it shows how people don't forget. We had a memorial service a few months after I found the wreck. 235 people, relatives, turned up for that 40 crew that were lost.
Mm.
So it's poignant.
Yeah, really. Definitely. And, yeah, I suppose that's the thing, because I remember being in the Rex Museum in Sweden, in Stockholm.
Mm, Nevasa.
Yeah, yeah, and they've got an exhibit now that talks about some other wrecks, and the bit they've got for the Estonia that sank,
yeah,
only in the,
yeah,
90s, so within
in the Baltic,
most,
yeah,
people's lifetimes.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really struck me about that is that, you know, people, again, people think that, oh, it's the 1990s, that's all modern. But their memorial to it is a loop of the radio communication between all the different ships that were looking for her. And the Estonia said, look, we think we're here. And everyone else was just like, well, okay, we'll head roughly in that direction. But the radio communication is not, we're at this location.
Yeah,
the radio information is, do you see any lights? Yeah, like, did your radar pick up something up? Like, well, we thought we saw something, but it's disappeared. And, oh, I found a lifeboat. Where are you? Well, I think you're those lights over there.
Yeah.
No one knew where they were. So as soon as darkness fell, that was it. It was as bad as it would have been in the Second World War.
Yeah, that happens in modern times. I remember a wreck in 1979 called the Paul Fisher. We were out on the lifeboat looking for the survivors on it. And basically all they had to go on was a Mayday that said, oh, we're going over off St. Catherine's Point. So nobody knew exactly this huge area where it was. And I actually found the wreck was supposedly marked, but because it's very difficult sometimes to identify if you've got a peak. And in those days, obviously, the equipment was fairly basic for Trinity House or whoever was looking for it. And I actually found the wreck 4 miles across the tide, you know. So, you know, it just shows how that can happen even in modern times.
Yeah. So to wrap this up, because obviously your time is very valuable.
No, it's fine.
What would you say? Are you going to continue looking for wrecks now?
Yeah. I mean, it's what I do, you know. I'm not too old for it, but the regulatory side of commercial diving now is prohibitive, you know, if you have your own business. So yeah, I'm going to keep doing it until I can't climb up the side of the boat, basically.
And is there any particular wrecks you want to?
Still got targets. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one that you will know. Basically, going back a few years now, was HMS Victory. I looked for that for years. Yeah, absolute years. The HMS Victory, I looked for it. It was my pet wreck that I wanted to find. You know, I looked for it for 20 years or something like that. And the theory was there, but, you know, I always thought it went out into deeper water and sank. But it shows that you can spend a huge amount of time and effort looking for one particular wreck, and you might never find it. We had the same in the Philippines. We looked in this horrendous area and did a really good survey, but at the end of the day, we never found, nor did any of the other major names that looked for it.
So what's the best way for people to support the work you do in the museum?
Well, we've been going, as I say, for 46 years, and we're lucky that we're pretty much the sole survivor now. The museum in Cornwall has just been put up for sale, as were several others. But we're lucky that we can keep sustainability and keep going. We love anybody to come and see us. You know, we've got a massive amount of shipwreck material here, maritime history, so we're always glad to welcome anybody.
Awesome. Right. Well, obviously, links in the description below if you want to come and visit the museum. And if you're based in the UK, it's half an hour, 45 minutes across by ferry. Faster if you take the hovercraft. Unfortunately, they've got rid of the big car-carrying one, which is a shame. But there you go. And, you know, if you're coming on holiday to the UK, well, if you're watching this channel, you're probably going to find your way down to Portsmouth at some point. So, again, pop across the Isle of Wight. It's not really that big an island, so it's fairly easy to find. Come and have a look at some of the wrecks here. The bits of the wrecks, the actual wrecks are still out there. And if you're really, really lucky, you might even run into to Martin and be able to have a chat like this one.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for your time.
No, you're welcome.
Thank you.
And there you go. There's obviously, as I said, a little bit more to come looking at some of the artifacts from specific wrecks in a future video. But please go and support the museum. Have a look on the website, link in the video description below. And if you do happen to visit, well, obviously mention that you came because of this video. You can see some real pieces of eight, like you can see here. So thanks for watching, everyone. And see you again in another video or at the museum.